You didn't have to do that, Rourke. Maybe you could've...
Would it do any good, Folsom, if I told you a hardware store owner once saved my life?
Folsom forced a smile, and Rourke clapped the man on the back, then tried looking through the crack in the canvas covering the back of the truck. They were heading into the woods on the far side of the city. Rourke anticipated the reason, but failed to see the logic. If they were planning a mass execution, why the harmless gas that had merely knocked out the men in the storm drain? Why the kid glove treatment of the men guarding the boats at the entrance to the storm drain? Why the careful bandaging of Folsom's shoulder, the antiseptic swabbing of the skinned left side of Rourke's face? Why? Korsinski's face appeared at the rear of the truck, a smile on his lips. He had even introduced himself to Rourke, confusing him further.
Mr. Rourke, you only, please. The others will be unharmed. And please, no more messy fist fights, agreed?
No promises. Your English is good for a military man, Korsinski.
Thank you. I understand you have been a writer. I appreciate such a compliment. You are a trained physician too, are you not?
Yeah, although lately I've been doing less healing and more wounding.
Yvonne, bring Mr. Rourke his guns.
What the hell?
Please, Mr. Rourke, please. Your weapons have been reloaded for you. Check for their functional reliability. I understand you may need them.
Are you setting me up?
Hardly. Just watching for your interests. The assault rifle was uninjured when it dropped. American guns I have always found to be sturdily built. Take them, please.
Rourke took the Colt Government 45. The finish was unscratched, despite the drop. He checked the metallified pistol. It was loaded, the chamber empty. He looked at Korsinski, then at the gun. The man nodded. He'd looked by the glare of the headlights, and the firing pin seemed in place as he held the gun awkwardly low while working the slide. He shoved it into his belt. Rourke finally received his twin Detonix pistols, reinserting them into the shoulder holsters under his arms. The bayonet and the A.G. Russell knife were cleaned and oiled. He sheathed them.
We took the liberty of reloading your spent magazine for the rifle. I'm afraid we had no American pistol ammunition available for your handgun.
Uh-huh. I'll let it slide.
Rourke took the CAR-15. It was unscratched, the scope intact. He watched two guards standing off at a distance twitch as he telescoped the stock and shouldered the rifle to check the scope, then replaced the scope covers and recollapsed the stock.
We found your motorcycle not far from the drive-in theater, Mr. Rourke. We assumed at least it was yours. It is waiting here for you.
How did you know about the drive-in?
Very simple, really. We threatened Folsom with killing him. He obliged by telling us. He felt obligated. We now have all of your men.
Oh, hell, they aren't my men.
Whoever they are, if you cooperate, they will go free. If you don't, they will be executed. And if they are freed, of course, their weapons will not be returned as yours have been. Come, I have a woman you might like to meet. Don't worry.
I won't.
Good.
Rourke followed the Soviet colonel out of the clearing and down a rough dirt path into the deeper part of the woods. He resettled the binoculars and the musette bag on his left shoulder as he walked, uncertain what Korsinski planned. Emerging into another smaller clearing, a staff car waited, its headlights burning and drawing swarms of night flies and moths. In the edge of the light beams stood a woman, slender, wearing a Soviet uniform, the skirt seemingly too long, Rourke observed. Korsinski walked toward her, Rourke beside him.
This young woman has a personal message for you, Mr. Rourke.
And what's to stop me from killing both of you?
You are not a murderer or an assassin. And, were you to do such a rash thing, or attempt to take one or the other of us hostage, all your men, or whose men they are, would be executed.
I'm not a murderer, but you are?
Something like that, if you choose to think of it that way.
So who are
I am instructed to tell you only this. I am General Ishmael Varakov's personal secretary. He asked that I give you this note, then you return the note to me after you have read it.
Rourke, you have impressed me with your singular competence and daring. The contents of this note are to be held in the strictest confidence. I will assume that I have your word as a gentleman on that. And it is an affair of gentlemen I discuss here. My niece Natalia, the wife of Vladimir Karamazov, is quite fond of you. And though I understand nothing actually transpired between you, that you both became close as friends. Her husband has quite recently beaten her severely, almost killing her toward the end, compelling her to defend herself. She is a faithful wife in her fashion, and would likely return to Karamazov sooner or later. I fear, as her uncle, that Karamazov will attack her again, this time permanently injuring her, or perhaps killing her. Because of political problems, I cannot kill Karamazov with my bare hands as I would like. I ask that you do this for me, however you wish. I have enclosed his projected itinerary for tomorrow. If you do this thing, all your comrades will be freed, the head of the American KGB will have been liquidated, surely something you can count as a benefit, and more important to both of us, Natalia's future safety will be secured. I ask this as one man of honor to another, despite our political differences. I will not consider myself indebted to you for this, other than personally. Karamazov is a madman, and for all our sakes, must be destroyed. Regards, V.
I am instructed to ask you for a yes or no answer.
Why me?
I know nothing about the letter. The general speaks excellent English and wrote it personally.
Yes.
Here.
It was an agenda for the next day, detailing Karamazov's movements. Rourke folded the paper again and placed it in the breast pocket of his shirt.
Anything else?
The general said if you said yes, I was to say good luck.
Hey, you're wearing your skirt too long. Oh, and thanks for the good wishes.
Vladimir Karamazov opened his eyes and looked through the motel balcony door. The motel was now the transient and bachelor officers' quarters. It was light, but rising from the bed and going toward the floor-to-ceiling glass, he opened the curtains wider and saw the fog. The fog seemed rank and foul and was cool, cold almost. Karamazov left the top floor drapes open, staring in the gray light at the woman on the bed. She was moving slightly, turning into the covers, cold apparently. He stared at her, walking across the room. He didn't exactly know why, but he had slapped her several times. He had been reminded by the bruise on her left cheek as she rolled toward the window. Unlike Natalia, she had liked the brutality. It was a side of himself to which he was, as yet, unaccustomed. He liked the brutality almost more than the sex afterward. Karamazov walked into the bathroom, looking at his face in the mirror. There were still bruises from where Natalia had struck him when she had so suddenly decided to defend herself. He walked back into the bedroom and looked at the blonde-haired woman sleeping there. He wondered, almost absently, what it would be like to kill Natalia. He shook his head to clear the thought away. He returned to the bathroom. He lathered his face to shave. He had picked up the Hofrath's razor at an exclusive shop in Rio. His face hurt where the bruises were as he grimaced in order to smooth the skin to shave closer. He made a mental note to inquire about the noise of explosions that previous morning. He had been out of the city interrogating some of the former university personnel at the detention center, trying to learn the whereabouts of the former astronaut Jim Colfax. He had thought, too, that faintly in the distance the previous night he had heard gunfire. There was a time he would have run to the sound, but he had been busy playing games with the woman on the bed, making her feel pain, which she seemed so to delight in. He brushed his teeth, carefully visually inspecting them in the bathroom mirror. The four stainless steel teeth that made a permanent bridge in the lower right side of his mouth. They were new and still uncomfortable. Before the war, when his primary duties had been to pose as anyone but a Russian, he would never have allowed the stainless steel teeth. Only Soviet dentists used them. Buttons stitched in a cross shape showed you had a European tailor. Keeping your fork in your left hand when you ate showed you were not American. There had been so many little things under which to submerge one's own personality, Karamazov thought. He began to dress. Civilian clothes again today, he thought. American blue jeans and a knit shirt, dark blue. He slipped on the shoulder holster for the Smith & Wesson Model 59. Since Natalia had taken his little revolver, he had found a replacement, slipping it into its belt holster and sliding the holster in place. He liked the revolver best, but the double-column 9mm Model 59 had firepower, and that was sometimes needed. He pulled a lined windbreaker from the closet and slipped it over the shirt and shoulder holster, then a baseball cap that read CAT on the front and advertised some sort of tractor. There was still the desire to look like the enemy, he thought, smiling at his American image in the mirror. He looked at the woman on the bed, decided not to wake her. She would likely come back again tonight. After it became known she had slept with one of the Russian conquerors, she would likely have no place else to go. Rourke had driven through the night, returned to the retreat by the most circuitous route to determine he wasn't followed. He had showered, changed, eaten, had a drink, and discussed what he had to do with Paul Rubinstein. While he had cleaned and checked his weapons, they had discussed the letter from Varakov and Rourke's promise to Natalia not to kill her husband. He disliked being cast in the role of an assassin. Yet, if Karamazov didn't die, and if Karamazov found out about the plan, he would most assuredly blame his wife and try to get his revenge. Perhaps, too, Rourke had thought out loud, Karamazov would kill her anyway. He had gotten the impression when they had met in Texas that, aside from being totally ruthless, Karamazov was also more than slightly insane. And now, having ridden through the fog, through the early morning hours, a fresh bandage in place on his cheek where he had skinned it, his guns freshly cleaned and checked and loaded, his knives touched up on the whetstone, he knew what he would do. Rourke dismounted the bike, seeing Karamazov coming down the steps and onto the sidewalk and starting his way. Rourke stripped off his leather jacket and the pistol belt with the Government 45. He had already cocked and locked the twin Detonic stainless pistols, and they rode now in their shoulder holsters under his armpits. He stepped from the alley into the foggy street, rolling his sleeves up as he walked. Karamazov had not seen him yet. He trusted to Varakov that Soviet patrols would be conspicuously absent. Rourke stripped the sunglasses from his face and pocketed them, the glare of the fog making him change his mind and put them back on. He stopped in the middle of the street, then walked to the curb and onto the sidewalk. He stopped again, two thin streams of gray smoke issuing from his nostrils as he exhaled. Karamazov had finally seen him.
Right here, okay, Karamazov?
Or what, Rourke? Are you going to tell me how wonderful my wife was in bed?
We never saw bed. I told you before, nothing happened.
Then why here? Why now? Why?
It's a long story. Look, go for your gun whenever you want. If you like, I'll wait while you ditch your coat.
All right, then. One gun? Two? I've never been in a Western gunfight before.
I don't think you will be again, so don't pay too much attention. It's not technique that counts so much anyway. It's not just speed, it's accuracy. That's why I figured 25 yards makes it more even for you against me. I might be faster, but you're probably just as accurate.
I'm so touched, Rourke. I can see why Natalia thinks so highly of you. And you can have her, the slut, the moment my back was turned after all my years of fidelity to her. And she, you plot to murder me.
If it matters, she doesn't know a thing about this. I even promised her once I wouldn't kill you. If I ever meet her again, she'll probably hate me for doing this.
You haven't done it yet, Rourke.
Have it your way. Now, whenever you're ready, just go for it. I'll watch your eyes and I'll know when to make my move.
Idiot. American fool!
I'll admit two grown men standing in the street and shooting at each other isn't too smart. It was just the fairest thing I could come up with on the spur of the moment.
Doesn't someone drop a handkerchief?
Uh-uh. That's only in the movies.
Done.
The chill wind lashed at John Rourke's face and hair as he bent low over the Harley-Davidson, the engine throbbing between his thighs. He glanced to his right, Rubinstein beside and slightly behind him. The escape from town had been surprisingly easy. Rourke decided Varakov was indeed a man of his word, but there was no way Rourke could imagine Korsinsky keeping to his portion of the bargain and releasing the rest of the men from the resistance. He could simply leave it out of his report to Varakov that they had been executed, but he would have waited for something to happen, some reason for Rourke's release, and once news of the death of Karamazov reached him, Korsinsky would know it would all be clear. They would all be dead.
Where are we going?
To a reunion! To a reunion!
Rourke turned and bent over the bike again. The fog was all but lifted, and it was nearly 9 a.m. as he glanced at the black face of the Rolex on his left wrist. Executions, he thought, were usually an early morning affair. Rourke made his turn, wide, onto the gravel road, taking him off the main highway and into the woods and down toward the clearing far beyond where he determined the hostage resistance fighters were still being kept. He had judged Korsinsky as being competent yet vain. He would never expect Rourke to come back and try to rescue his so-called comrades. Rourke counted heavily on that, for even with Paul Rubinstein at his side, the odds were heavily stacked against him. Where, John?
Up there, not far ahead through the woods. Too many Russians on the highways.
We got a chance?
If we didn't have a chance, we wouldn't be here. Over there, maybe 500 yards. Come on.
You want the SSG, Rourke?
Nope, I'll stick with this bad boy.
Rourke unslung the CAR-15 from his back. The rifle, stock collapsed, slung under his right shoulder, his fist wrapped around the pistol grip. He started forward, Rubinstein moving behind him. The air was cold, damp, and foul-smelling from the patches of fog still clinging in the shadows of the trees low along the ground. Rourke walked slightly stooped over, threading his way under low branches and around bushes laden with 2-inch-long thorns, bright green-leaved brush swatting at his hands and thighs as he pushed his way past. Judging he'd gone half the distance, he signaled a stop with his left hand, held a finger to his lips for silence, and dropped into a low crouch. They moved ahead more slowly. Dropping to the ground, Rourke signaled Rubinstein to do the same. Both men moved ahead on their knees and elbows, crawling over the rough ground. Rourke could see the outline of the upper half of a uniformed man above the low-rising natural hedgerow. He motioned Rubinstein to stay back, handing him off the CAR-15 and palming out the Sting 1A from inside his trousers. Rising to his knees and elbows, he inched forward. Again, Rourke stopped, the sentry clearly in view, an AK-47 at high port as the man stared over the hedgerow, Rourke beneath his line of sight. There was no chance of getting around behind the man, Rourke decided. He pushed himself up slightly and scanned the woods as best he could for signs of other sentries. He picked one man on the far side of the clearing, opposite this man, and turned back to the clearing, so far staying away from Rourke's own position. Then Rourke spotted a third man, far to his left, standing beside the collection of Soviet vehicles. Korsinsky's staff car was there, but Rourke doubted the man had spent the night in the open field in the woods. Perhaps he had returned to preside over the execution.
Men, bring the prisoners from the truck.
Rourke spotted a fourth sentry far to his right by 2 large tents, these apparently set up to house the men who had guarded the hostages overnight. There was activity in the clearing. The execution, Rourke realized, was imminent. He looked back to the sentry almost immediately ahead of him, still staring out blankly over the hedgerow. Rourke edged forward, the Sting clamped in his teeth. It was risky, what he planned, but it was all he could do. He was less than 5 feet from the sentry now, slightly to the soldier's right. He wiped the blood from his hands on the soldier's uniform shirt. Rourke dragged the body under a bush, then stripped away the ammo from the man's belt and snatched up the AK-47, looking behind him, signaling Rubinstein to come ahead. Rourke inched into the hedgerow. A full view now of the clearing showed perhaps a dozen Russian soldiers forming up into a long single rank. The corners of Rourke's mouth turned down as he squinted at the weapons the men held, the motley collection used by the resistance people and Reed and his men. Rourke looked to his left and saw Reed, the corporal, the other two men, Folsom and Darren Ball, and the 20 or so others who had survived the previous night's fiasco being marched from the trucks parked at the far end of the clearing toward the center of the clearing. It was the execution. The look on Paul's face showed that he too saw the preparations for the mass murder. Rourke took back his CAR-15, passed over the spare magazines for the AK-47, then the gun itself to Rubinstein, pointing out to him the safety selector. Busily, Rubinstein stuffed the spare magazines into the belt cinched around his waist, nodding. Rourke gestured to Rubinstein, then pointed out into the clearing toward where the firing squad was formed. The resistance people were already straggling toward it. He pointed toward his own mouth and opened it wide as though shouting, pointed to the AK-47 in Rubinstein's hand, then held his own hands as if holding some kind of invisible submachine gun, then swept the imaginary weapon from side to side, then pointed back at the ranked firing squad. Rubenstein nodded grimly. Rourke signaled with his fingers, a walking motion to Rubenstein, and then pointed along the tree line. Again, the younger man nodded. Rourke snatched up the CAR-15 and removed the scope covers, then pushed himself up into a crouch and started off to the right, toward the stand of pines serving as the backstop for the firing squad's bullets. Rourke reached the trees, flattening himself behind one as best he could, glancing down to his weapon, slowly, as noiselessly as possible, telescoping the collapsible stock, entwining his left arm in the sling, looking right and left, then edging forward again. The resistance fighters and Reed and his men partially shielded Rourke, he realized, from the view of the firing squad as he raced in a low crouch toward the center of the stand. He could see Korsinsky, the greatcoat open, the swagger stick braced in his gloved hands, then slowly raising his right hand.
Men! Ready! Aim! Reed, Folsom, ball, hit the dirt!
The first slug kicked at the swagger stick in Korsinsky's gloved right hand, knocking the colonel back. Rourke swept the scope to Korsinsky's head, Rubenstein's gunfire with the AK-47 already mowing into the line of executioners. Some of the men running and throwing down the unfamiliar weapons they held, some starting to shoot back. Rourke aimed for Korsinsky's head, this time getting close enough to send a 5.56 millimeter solid through the peak of the colonel's hat.
Next one kills you! Call a ceasefire!
Ceasefire! Immediately! Ceasefire!
Reed, you and the rest of the men get your weapons and gear. Disarm the Russians. Come on, move it! Hurry!
At the back of his mind, Rourke realized the gunfire might bring some more of the Soviet troops down on him, or perhaps one of the Russians out there would take it into his head to become a hero and snatch up a gun and start shooting.
Korsinsky, tell your men that if there are any thoughts of heroics, to forget them. You'll be the first to die, I promise you that. A bullet right in the head.
Do as he says!
All right. Line them all up so we can get out of here.
Kill him!
Korsinsky, you move and you're dead!
Rourke wheeled to his left, placing the bead from the scope of the CAR-15 on Ball's black synthetic rifle buttstock, which he had aimed at the head of a Soviet lieutenant. Rourke shifted the CAR-15 to his left hand, snatching the metallified government model Colt from the hip holster. He pointed the gun at Korsinsky's midsection. Rourke's eyes darted back and forth between the two men.
What the hell'd you do that for?
You were gonna execute that man.
So what the hell?
So murder isn't any better if you're doing it or they're doing it. Touch a gun to anyone and I'll drop you. I swear it.
Mr. Good Guy, huh? Bullshit!
You got a pistol in your belt, Ball. Why don't you try using it?
Strange behavior for Verikov's private assassin, Mr. Rourke. Karamazov was, what is the word, the best at, I think.
More or less. You're no prince yourself, though. All of you, split up in small groups, take off through the woods. Reed, you and your men stick with me. Folsom, too. Darren, steal a vehicle. Take about 5 or 6 men with you. Torch it under some bridge when you're ready to get rid of it.
Till we meet again, then, Rourke.
Till we meet again.
As the resistance fighters began to disperse, Rourke had Rubenstein take over watching Korsinsky, then helped Reed and his men and Folsom load every Soviet weapon they could find aboard a truck.
At least you've got some of the weapons you need, Folsom.
Is there a traitor with us?
No, higher up, I think. Captain Reed's men kept radioing what we were doing. I think it's somebody back in Texas.
No way, Rourke. That's out of line. I'll call in directly to command headquarters. Only the top people know.
Then it must be one of the top people. There was evidence of that when they so neatly snatched Chambers at the airfield where he'd landed in Texas.
You mean Karamazov had somebody when he gunned down that pilot?
Yeah. And to nail us last night, Verikov must still have him now. There's one sure way to know. Only one. Folsom, where's Jim Colfax supposed to be?
Up in the mountains near Helen, Georgia. Got a Swiss chalet-like house up there he inherited when his brother died. One of my guys spotted him still at the house 2 days ago. My man had seen him on TV.
Where exactly?
I'll draw you out a map. And thanks, Rourke. We'll look for your family. How do we contact you?
You contact Army Intelligence. I'll contact them.
What about the traitor?
I'll know for sure if there's one at your headquarters after today. Helen's about 2 hours from here. I used to take Sarah and the kids there. Beautiful place. You have your man radio in just like you normally would. Tell him you expect to be up there in 3 hours. The Russians won't pass up a chance to get Colfax and us all at the same time, so they'll wait. But we'll be there an hour earlier.
Is that enough time?
I'm leaving now with Paul. The bikes can make better time. Have Folsom give you another map like the one he's making for me, then you follow in one of the Russian vehicles. Have Folsom show you some side roads and possible alternates on your own maps, and we'll rendezvous at Colfax's place. Leave two of your men some distance off to warn us when the Russians begin to show.
Rourke?
Yeah?
Forget about that fight, huh? I owe you my neck.
What fight, Reed? Rubenstein, let's hit the road.
It began to mist less than 10 minutes into the 2-hour ride into the mountains, and soon the mist turned into a driving, road-slicking rain. Rourke, with Rubenstein riding dead even beside him to minimize the spray of the wheels against the highway, was soaked through. Because of the driving rain, their speed was cut just to keep control, and as Rourke turned off the highway onto the side road Folsom had indicated for him, he glanced at his watch. It had taken slightly over 2.5 hours, and might well take Reed, unfamiliar with the area, even longer.
The Colfax place should be at the end of this road, then a driveway. There's a wooded area behind the house. No suitable spot for helicopters to land if the Soviets use air cavalry, but they might be able to rappel down to the ground. You're gonna want Colfax alive to get the information on the Eden Project, the same as we want.
At the end of the road was a gravel driveway, and Rourke cut left, turning onto it, relieved at the more stable road surface. The house directly ahead looked as though it had been lifted from the Bavarian Alps. The cuckoo clock-like structure had a second-floor porch traveling the width of the house, shuttered windows and doorways facing onto it. Below, a smaller porch, ornamental, gingerbread-style woodwork, brightly painted, adorning each cornice and corner. Rourke and Rubenstein stopped their bikes 10 feet from the house, kicking out their stands and dismounting. The CAR-15, the muzzle cap in place and dust cover closed, was slung muzzle down across his back and his upturned collar streaming water onto his shirt. He pushed his wet hair from his forehead and walked toward the small first-floor porch, looking up at the second floor for some sign of habitation.
Paul, go around back. I don't want Colfax to duck out on us.
The younger man nodded, his thinning hair plastered to his forehead by the rain. Rourke fished into his wallet, pulling out his plastic-coated CIA identity card, then replaced the wallet in his pocket.
My name is Rourke. I'm with American Intelligence. CIA card here in my hand. Jim Colfax, I'm here to help you. Open up!
Rourke!
What's going on?
Is Colfax a white-haired guy with a crew cut?
Yeah, I think so.
He's out there. I saw him. Must have heard us coming up and took off. You said he has heart trouble. That's why he quit the astronaut program?
Damn it, yeah.
Then we better hurry to stop him. I'm not sure, but either he's got a funny way of running or he was holding both hands over his chest.
My God. Get your bike. Come on.
Rourke hit the tree line, swinging around one of the narrow tree trunks, scanning the woods right and left. He spotted a white-haired man running up the steeply sloping grade 100 yards deeper into the pines.
Colfax! Jim Colfax! I'm an American! I don't want to hurt you. I'm here to help. Over there! Right toward the slope, Paul!
I'll get to him!
Rourke started running through the trees, dodging the sparse brush, jumping deadfalls, his feet slipping in the mud, catching himself on his hands, pushing to his feet and continuing to run. Rourke could see Colfax up ahead and Rubenstein zigzagging through the trees trying to cut him off.
Colfax! Wait, man!
Rubenstein was at the far edge of the woods and Colfax was running laterally to Rourke's left along the slope.
Colfax! Wait!
Rourke saw the white-haired athletic man stumble and fall, rolling down the slope, his body slithering across the red mud of the clay wash and colliding against a tree stump and stopping.
Over here, Paul! Damn it. He doesn't have a pulse. The Eden Project.
But can't you do anything?
No, Paul. If I had a hospital or a trained cardiac team, maybe I could start the heart again. He was dead before I reached him. The eyelids just came open as a reflex action when I bent his head away. He's gone.
Then, what's up there? What's the Eden Project, John?
Rourke set the white-haired man's head down on the ground, closing the eyelids with his thumbs. Then stood and stared up at the gray sky, rain washing across his face.
The Russians will bury him.
But...
What's up there? Is that what you're asking? Cheer up, Paul. Maybe it isn't a doomsday machine or a weapon of some sort. Who knows? Maybe the Eden Project is something that'll do some good. One way or another, the last man who knew is dead.
The Russians came, ransacking the house and surrounding environs. Rourke and Rubenstein had completed searching the house long before Reed had arrived, going with him to a place of concealment on high ground in a cleft of rocks long before the Soviet helicopters had descended.
I guess I can tell you now, Rourke.
Tell me what?
Well, before I do, Folsom, we used my radio. He wanted to do something for you. He's got a contact in the resistance up in Tennessee. Hadn't said anything to you because he didn't want to get any false hopes up. Got a message out last night before the raid, and the resistance man in Tennessee promised he'd check around. Folsom just had a feeling about it. Made me call in on their frequency. Well, guy owns a farm. His wife is the aunt of an only survivor of the Jenkins family you mentioned. The guy was a retired army sergeant. His son, anyway, just joined up with him. Got wounded last night. They talked. Sarah and your kids are up at his farm. Been there the last few days.
Where?
Take this map. It's marked. Up near some place called Mount Eagle in the mountains. You know it?
What? Yeah, Mount Eagle. Yeah, I know it.
Thank God, John.
Reed. Folsom, can you thank him for me? Will you thank him for me?
I'll see him. Just in case, I'm leaving Paul the radio set we have and some parts from the kit. You want to contact us? The frequency will be marked. One other thing.
Yeah?
John, they'll think maybe you found out before Colfax died. The Russians will want you. They want to know what the Eden Project was, almost more than we do. You were right about that traitor. Looks like there's someone among Chambers' advisors who works for the Communists.
Well, I'll leave that to you, Captain. Say goodbye to your men for me, huh? When I get back here, I'll have Sarah cook you and Paul the best meal in the world at the retreat. I'll see you there as soon as I can get them back.
Sure, John. Hey, John, if something goes wrong, just...
It won't. It won't.
It was dark, cold, and the roads slick as Rourke turned off the highway and into the mountain passes. It had been a fool's play, taking what had once been the interstate, but the fastest route. He'd dodged a Russian roadblock perhaps 75 miles back, then taken to the interstate again. The farm where Sarah was staying was less than 20 miles ahead, according to the map. Rourke passed a farmhouse, a demolished sandbag fence crumbling around it, the roof burnt off, and no signs of light or life in the rainy darkness. He traveled on past dense woods, higher into the mountains, and saw a yellow light in the darkness. Sarah. He remembered the last time they had made love, just before he had gone to Canada, a few days before the night of the war. They had decided to try again. His passion, as she called it, for guns, for planning for disaster, for studying survivalism, had been the undoing, she'd said so often. But she had been willing to try again, to see somehow if the two of them could resolve his planning for the inevitable with her yearning for peace. He remembered the look and smell of her dark hair, the gray-green eyes. He remembered kissing her in the rain and how she tasted. And there would be Michael, just 9, but a man in so many ways already. The best of Sarah and the best of himself. And little Annie, 6, small, beautiful, prone to too many tears and bizarre but lovely laughter. Annie.
Who are you?
Relax, son. Is Mary here?
I'm Mary.
I'm John. John Rourke. My wife, Sarah, my boy, Michael, my daughter, Annie, I've come for them.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. She was worried about you. I offered that she could stay or at least leave the little boy and girl here after what she did for my sister's girl. I offered.
Where are they?
She wouldn't. She wanted to go look for you. Back into Georgia. She left this morning.
Horseback?
Yes. One for her, one for the boy and girl, and one for their things.
Were they armed?
An AR-15 that somebody converted to a full auto and a rubber grip 45 pistol.
Are they well? No one been injured?
Fine, healthy. Nothing wrong with them as far as I could tell.
Toward Georgia, you said. Any idea of the route?
I think she was going to take the old highway that runs along the interstate. You know it?
Yes, thank you. And thank you, ma'am. We'll never forget your kindness. Should she come back here before I find her and the children, keep her here. And you, son, If you hear of where she is or where she's been, get the Resistance to contact Army Intelligence in Texas. Somehow.
Yes, sir.
Good night, ma'am.
God bless you, Mr. Rourke. And may he grant that you find them.
Yes, ma'am. I hope he does.
He left the porch and walked back through the mud toward his Harley. When he got there, he mounted up and sat staring up at the lightless sky, wondering how it could be that he'd gotten so close and yet missed Sarah and the children by a day.
One day.
God damn it!
He gunned the Harley down the road and into the darkness. Survivalist The Quest is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1981, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Azelford, Mort Shelby, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, Michael Glenn, Dylan Lynch, and Michael John Casey. Additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Azelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Adapted for graphic audio by Matt Jacobs. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, wallpapers, ringtones, and games. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title. Coming soon from Graphic Audio's Truly Frightening series.
I busied myself to think of a story which would speak to the mysterious fears of our nature and awaken thrilling horror. I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together.
How gladly I would sacrifice my fortune, my existence, my every hope, to the furtherance of my enterprise.
Unhappy man! Do you share my madness? Have you drunk also of the intoxicating draught? Hear me. Let me reveal my tale, and you will dash the cup from your lips.
By the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. A cold dew covered my forehead. My teeth chattered and every limb became convulsed when, by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch.
No!
The miserable monster whom I had created. His jaws opened, and a grin wrinkled his cheeks. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed downstairs. I took refuge in the courtyard belonging to the house which I inhabited, where I remained during the rest of the night. Listening attentively, watching and fearing each sound as if it were to announce the approach of the demoniacal corpse to which I had so miserably given life.
It was a story to make the reader dread to look round, to curdle the blood, and quicken the beatings of the heart.
Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's Frankenstein. Coming soon from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.